Hello and welcome to the Journeymen Podcast. I'm Joseph Corliss.
And I'm Mark Reeves. Join us as we travel from club to club, delving into the stories, tales and myths that have helped define the ethos and identities of football clubs all around the world. We'll look at club history from all angles, whether it be the team's tactical style, superstitious fan rituals, or discussing the best players to grace the shirt.
From our base in Berlin, we aspire to give clubs of all sizes a platform to discuss their greatest triumphs and toughest heartbreaks. We'll take you through fascinating, untold stories with tales of heroes, villains, promotions, relegations, and everything in between. And this is our first inaugural episode. We're going to be jumping into Blackpool Football Club, the Seasiders. And I think I can speak on behalf of both of us here when we say that we have very, very fond memories of the likes of Ian Holloway's press conferences, Charlie Adam scoring goals at Old Trafford and Anfield. What about yourself, Mark?
All of the above, like amazing attacking football in the Premier League. Great front three, DJ Campbell, Gary Taylor Fletcher, Brett Ormerod, and also, of course, Bucktail FC on Pro Evolution Soccer. Like, you can't forget that.
Can't forget that. After jumping into the history of the club, we realised, obviously, the history of Stanley Matthews and that 53 final, the first Ballon d'Or winner ever. But there's so much to this club, and we're so excited to take you on a tale through Blackpool Football Club. Yeah. So I hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
Near side is Harewood, Ormerod in the centre, Taylor Fletcher as well. Taylor Fletcher coming in! And it's Blackpool's first goal in the Premier League! Made by the new boy Marlon Harewood and poked home by Gary Taylor Fletcher.
Maybe we start with just a little bit of information on Blackpool, the town itself, just to paint the picture for people that don't necessarily know it, if we're lucky enough to have any international listeners. Blackpool is a town of about 140,000 people, not too far away from Liverpool, Manchester, and most famous for the Tower, which of course was modelled on the Eiffel Tower.
Blackpool rose to prominence
In the early 20th century
as a seaside resort, as many other seaside towns in the UK did at the time.
Booming time of the railways, like people can suddenly go out to the coast, have a holiday. But I'd say the booming times of like the 50s really corresponds with the football club, like with the town itself. So at the Opera House, for example, you had names like the Beatles, Jimi Hendrix, and even more amazing, which we neither of us knew, Frank Sinatra in 1953, which would also proved to be a very successful year for the football club. Yeah, and unfortunately, as the 20th century started to come to an end, the demand for the classic British seaside town began to fade, which obviously you can link to cheap Ryanair flights and things like this, which sort of loosely corresponds with the fortunes of the football club, would you say?
You could definitely draw that link. It's almost eerily similar how the city and the football club both fall and rise with one another.
Okay, so that's the geography of the town. What about Joey, you set us up on some football geography.
Yeah, the local area, obviously this Blackpool is based within the county of Lancashire, and Lancashire is home to many, many football teams.
So many teams in Lancashire, Greater Manchester.
Like, the likes of Liverpool, Manchester United, Manchester City, but then even playing host to other former Premier League giants like Blackburn and a historical club like Preston North End, who are Blackpool's main vicious rivals.
One of the things that we've sort of learned through speaking to fans, there's some great nicknames they give each other. Some of the things we've got there, obviously we spoke about the Tower. That lot with the Tower is a...
That was Preston manager Gary Peters. He took it so seriously that throughout all of his press conferences as manager as Preston.
And then Blackpool fans in return actually call the Preston fans sheep shaggers, which they respond to the Blackpool fans as the donkey lashes. You know, there's some effort going into these names.
You were fortunate enough to get in touch with a Preston fan, friend of yours, Bird. In his entire email, he didn't refer to Blackpool as Blackpool or Seasiders. He referred to them as the Seaside Shit.
Yeah, it was almost as if he said the word Blackpool, he would like burn. And like every time the name needed to be mentioned, it was the Seaside Shit. But don't worry, Blackpool fans, if you're listening, like, we're not going to dwell on what Preston think or call you.
We have a great admiration for both fan bases with the creativity of the nicknames. However, despite these changing nicknames for one another, they've had quite an unusually high amount of players who have managed to play for both teams.
It tends to be especially a thing you notice being from Northern England. When you look at like these footballers' careers, and it's amazing how like a lot of players tend to stick in the same area. For example, players that play for Blackpool quite often play for Preston, Bolton, Fleetwood, and they stick to this area. area. I suppose it saves you having to buy a new house every time you move somewhere.
Definitely. And then they also, in more recent times, the Fylde Coast Derby has been formed with Fleetwood Town. The first meeting of these two teams wasn't until 1980, in which Blackpool won 4-0. However, the rivalry between Blackpool and Fleetwood really kicked off once they were relegated to League One from the Championship back in 2015. And since then, they've met 10 times in the last 6 years.
It's interesting the sort of upper hand that Blackpool have. Like, they've won 7 of the games and only actually lost once to Fleetwood.
A spot kick that might have given Blackpool a draw in that game. This is even more crucial, though. A chance for Blackpool. Lonergan to try to deny Wes Houlihan, who scores! Houlihan! Oh, what a cheeky penalty that was! And just look at the wild celebrations among the 3,000 and odd Blackpool supporters.
Jumping into the very beginnings is Blackpool as a football club. They weren't known as Blackpool. In fact, they were called Victoria FC back in 1877. That is the first very instance.
So Victoria FC, interestingly, only lasted 9 years before a meeting in the Stanley Arms in Blackpool, Stanley being quite fitting for later on. The fans decided to shut the club down and basically start a new club that would represent the whole of Blackpool, giving us, of course, Blackpool FC.
The new club managed to win 2 pieces of silverware in its first season of existence, which is pretty impressive, winning the local Fylde Cup and the Lancashire Junior Cup.
The club's first ever football league game wasn't until 1896, a game at Lincoln City, and it was quite an interesting journey to get there.
It took the Blackpool team 6 hours to travel just 240 kilometres or 150 miles. And the players, directors and the club doctor had to catch the 7 a.m. train for Blackpool North and endured journey via Manchester and Birmingham. They had to change trains on 2 occasions, with the players' only form of any form of warm-up coming as a run up and down the platform.
Yeah, which is a far cry from today's modern training grounds, fancy coaches and things.
Definitely.
Interestingly enough, much to the sort of still relatively young club's fans, in 1899, it was decided the club would go through yet another merger. Like, this is about the third or fourth sort of merger when you include the things from Victoria FC as well, with local rivals South Shore.
The merger was completed on the 12th of December 1899, and I think the best thing to come from this was, in fact, that is how they gained their famous ground, Bloomfield Road, with, yeah, with the teams moving to what was South Shore's ground.
And interestingly enough, like the time we've just been speaking about, so Blackpool wasn't actually wearing their famous tangerine shirts. And Joey, as we found out all the way through this, do not call it orange.
Yeah, throughout our research and our discourse with Blackpool fans, it was made very clear to us that it is tangerine and not orange.
I think even the Blackpool Supporters Club is literally called It's Tangerine, Not Orange, or It's Not Orange, It's Tangerine.
One of the club's directors, going by the name of Albert Hargreaves, was an international referee. And in fact, he noticed the vivid orange shirts of the Netherlands and decided he was so impressed by this vivid colour. And he persuaded the directors of the Seasiders to adopt the tangerine colour.
Yeah, the colours were adopted and universal praise from the fans at the time, which I think, looking back, like, these colours must have been so, it's so vibrant and so different to anything else really around at this time.
Absolutely. You could imagine the likes of Stanley Matthews flying down the wing in these bright, vivid tangerine shirts. And I can only imagine it being a feast for the eyes to see him, yeah, dancing past players and scoring goals for the Seasiders.
To be fair, they had pretty, like, as we're saying, pretty successful early beginnings. Once they sort of, the merger had been completed with South Shore and they're playing at Bloomfield Road. So, like, by 1925, they've actually increased the capacity to around 20,000. A theme that will run throughout this podcast, there's these big, like, crucial games in Blackpool's history that always seem to be against a local rival, a Blackburn, a Preston. And it was actually 1924-25 season, they made it to the fourth round of the FA Cup for the first time, in front of 60,000 fans against Blackburn. Just to set the scene of where football was at this point, Blackpool in like the mid-20s to the late-20s, were still weren't appointing full-time managers. Like, they were cutting costs and giving titles as honorary manager, a director who wasn't really getting paid to manage the team, who would just put some names on the sheet, basically.
Yeah, one of the examples of this, Harry Evans, who, to be fair to him, even with this like kind of honorary manager title, did manage them for a solid 5 years. He clearly enjoyed managing Blackpool. With the perspective of modern football, the idea of, say, a winger being played at wing back doesn't seem that crazy. However, back at Blackpool, things were a little bit different.
Yeah, and I think you can pick up this in football in sort of those early years quite a lot, with positioning was very different and he wasn't always a striker, things could change. And a great example is Billy Tremlin, who actually in the 26-27 season had scored 31 goals, but because Blackpool had signed a new forward, he was actually later moved to centre-back, or centre-half as it was called, to accommodate a new talent coming through, Jimmy Hampson.
The idea of Mbappe starting for centre-back for PSG is what like comes to mind.
Just seeing like a younger, better Mbappe coming through. Jimmy Hampson would then go on to be a real legend for Blackpool. The 45 league goals he scored in the 29-30 season, which is the most in the country, was a Blackpool record for a single season and still stands.
Off the back of Jimmy's 45 league goals, he fired Blackpool to become Division 2 champions, their only league title to date.
Yeah, and that was to reach the top flight for the first time in their history, including holding their nerve in an important victory at fellow title challengers and, of course, local rivals, Oldham Athletic, in front of a crowd of 45,000. As the World War II years approach, a lot of professional footballers obviously find themselves having to enlist and actually, you know, go to war.
The seaside town played host to a few players throughout this period, the likes of Ronnie Dix, who featured for Tottenham, Bristol Rovers and Blackburn Rovers, and Alex Stevenson, who played for Everton. But there was also an outside right who was a regular international and played club football for Stoke City.
Of course, his name, Stanley Matthews. And he made regular appearances during the war years with Blackpool and teaming up with a promising youngster, which we'll speak a bit more about soon, Stan Mortensen. So the war actually cost Matthews his professional career from the age of 24 to 30. Lost quite a lot of time, but he didn't waste it, did he? So he joined the RAF and was based just outside of Blackpool.
Matthews, in fact, made 87 guest appearances for Blackpool during the war, alongside with a handful of appearances for Morton, Rangers, and plus even one sole game for Arsenal against Dynamo Moscow, which in modern times could definitely be a Europa League tie.
But I think it's just so hard to imagine these war years when you've got players dotted around the country in the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, making appearances for whichever local team they have.
Yeah, the idea of Jack Grealish just randomly playing for, say, Newcastle because he's stationed there, because that's where the planes are, just seems impossible to think of in this modern era.
Yeah, and so at the outbreak of World War II, September 1939, Blackpool were actually top of the First Division after winning their opening three games.
So one weird positive aspect of the war continuing for Blackpool was the fact that pre-war, they had a bank overdraft of just over £33,000, which equates to around £2.2 million in today's money. The armed forces required Bloomfield Road for various reasons, and this meant that the War Office, in fact, paid Blackpool to use the ground. This meant that once the war was over, the club had become completely solvent once again.
So when peace returned to Europe, Blackpool actually found themselves in a much healthier financial position than the start of the war. And these were some booming years. Attendances at grounds across the country were through the roof, and Blackpool's attractive football really appealed to fans, and they flocked to Bloomfield Road in their thousands. Manager Joe Smith, who'd actually been in charge since before the war, since 1935, gathered around him some of the most talented footballers in the country at the time. With the help of Stan Mortensen's 28 goals, the team actually finished the 46-47 season in fifth position, which is the highest final position they'd achieved up to that point.
However, one man was missing from Joe Smith's squad, and that was in fact Stanley Matthews, who in turn went back to his parent club, Stoke. He went on to play another 23 games, and I'm sorry, Stoke City fans, but this is the definition of a one-man team, with him scoring 30 of the club's 41 league goals during that 46-47 season. However, he was still desperate to return to Blackpool and still lived in the area.
So after submitting two transfer requests in 1947, Stoke finally sanctioned Matthews' move back to Blackpool. And I feel like transfer request is a very modern term, and I'm just imagining Peter Odemwingie driving and sulking outside of QPR's ground, but I don't think the fine man Matthews would have done such a thing. By the 10th of May 1947, Matthews made his move back to Blackpool for just over £11,000 at the time, at the tender age of 32.
Joe Smith, in fact, made it a personal thing for Stanley Matthews, stating, "You're 32, but do you think you can do it for a couple of more years?" Smith then went on to tell Matthews that there are no shackles here, express yourself. Play your own game, and whatever you do on the pitch, do it in the knowledge that you have my full support.
I think this is very fitting for then what sort of happens after. So we transition into this era when Blackpool are playing this really attractive football, a really successful era for the club.
Three FA Cup finals in 6 years paint a picture in itself. Unfortunately, in 1948, they lost one to Manchester United. They lost the second one in 1951 to Newcastle United. However, it was third time lucky in 1953 with their win against Bolton. However, this is where we jump headfirst into probably the most successful day, single day, in Blackpool's club history, the Matthews Final, 1953.
The Duke of Edinburgh meets the boys from Blackpool at Wembley before their cup final battle with Bolton Wanderers. Matthews again, giving the game everything he's got. In the Bolton goal, Hansen gets ready for work. The great little wizard has it again. A flick to centre finds Perry, who crashes it home into the Bolton net. Blackpool 4, Bolton 3. There's no doubt about it now. Matthews, recently ignored by the England selectors, is the man of the match. What a great reception he gets from all at Wembley as the whistle goes. Matthews, in his third cup final, is the hero of the day. Her Majesty the Queen rises to greet the two teams and to award the cup. And here come the winners, gallant Blackpool, who turned what seemed defeat into one of the most dramatic victories ever seen at Wembley.
What an occasion. 100,000 people packed into Wembley, a sea of tangerine. And also the first major TV audience for a sporting event.
So joining that 100,000 in attendance was millions around the country. As Mark's just said, this was broadcast live on TV for the first time, roughly around the same time as the Queen's coronation. So it worked quite well.
Yeah, this was... The coronation was really the reason why people had TVs. Like, this was being broadcast, so everyone was rushing out to buy them, and the BBC had this great idea, let's put the FA Cup final on, and yeah, the rest is history.
And Stanley Matthews, with his man of the match performance, really went on to put on a show for the thousands and thousands of people watching as Blackpool came from behind with only 17 minutes to go. They were 3-1 down to Bolton, who... Looking from watching the highlights, myself and Mark have done, Bolton did look the slightly better team. However, I think it was the quality of the likes of Stanley Matthews and Stan Mortensen that really was a cutting edge in the last 10 minutes.
Yeah, and to get an 89th minute equaliser and a 92nd minute winner for the first FA Cup final, like first large major sporting event on TV, is pretty good going. The final, often referred to as, you know, the greatest FA Cup final of all time, but more often the Matthews final, which you've got to feel is a tad harsh on our friend Stan Mortensen, don't you think?
He went on to get a hat-trick in the final, and somehow the final is not named after him. Stanley Matthews, however, when you watch the highlights, looks such like a modern player. He's dropping shoulders, he's fainting, he's moving his legs in ways that none of the other players really on the pitch are really doing. So you can see why such a huge audience would have been captivated by what was to be called the Wizard of the Dribble, or the Magician in fact.
That's one thing that really stands out to you when you watch the game, is how modern he looks. Like, the footage of him with the football from this game wouldn't look that out of place nowadays. Like, he's running at wing backs, he's trying to take people on, cut inside. I think this is why he's held in such high regard, because people had never seen this way of playing football before.
In a later documentary in the 70s, he featured speaking about the final, saying that his favourite way, in fact, was to beat a defender on the outside, which is, in fact, how perfectly he was the architect of the winning goal, as he cut on the outside and cut the ball back, nicely placed for Bill Perry, South African, to score the winner, who was stood just about on the penalty spot.
This guy, a few years later, goes on to win the first ever Ballon d'Or in his 40s while still playing for Blackpool in 1956, which I think says everything you need to know about him, to be honest.
He's up there literally with Ronaldo and Messi, literally.
Beckenbauer said that the speed and skill that Matthews possessed, that nobody could stop him at this point. Like, he literally, like, nobody could stop him. This is even when he's well into his 40s. Like, it's crazy, crazy.
He certainly passes the eye test, to use modern football.
Yeah.
It would be doing a disservice to Stanley Matthews' teammate in Stan Mortensen, as he put away three goals.
This guy, he scored a ridiculous amount of goals for Blackpool, but he also just, he loved the FA Cup. There's this, obviously, the hat-trick in the 53 final, but on the way to the 48 final that they ended up losing to Manchester United, he actually scored in 12 consecutive rounds of the FA Cup, including the final, which I think is a great stat.
Morty went on to score 197 goals in 317 appearances for the Mighty Tangerines.
Really cemented himself as a legend. Like, you know, if scoring a hat-trick in an FA Cup final that your club wins isn't enough. But also a few years later, when Blackpool were in a bit of financial trouble, he actually auctioned his medals off to help the club.
and unfortunately as well passed away 4 days before his 70th birthday on the 22nd of May in 1991, the same day, eerily, that Blackpool reached Wembley for the first time since 1953, since that epic final.
That's incredible. Hence why there's a statue actually put up of him at Bloomfield Road in 2005. He actually scored more post-war goals for Blackpool than anybody else, and amazingly was the club's top goal scorer for 10 years straight in between 1945 and 1955.
That level of consistency isn't even seen in today's standards at all. So that's the stat, in my opinion, the 10 seasons straight of being one club's top goal scorer is the one that, in my opinion, validates him as a true legend of Blackpool Football Club.
And I think Joe Smith, the manager during this period, this team he's built and the attacking football, and you read these goal stats, I don't know whether he's given enough credit, like, I don't want to speak for everybody, but before we researched this podcast, I'd not heard of Joe Smith before. And he seems a real pioneer. In fact, he actually occupied the Blackpool job for 23 years. I think you've got some insights of his pre-match team talk.
Yeah, weirdly, considering you'd think a man of his longevity, he was rather laid back when it came to the big day, in front of that massive audience.
Seems like most of the squad was, I think.
Yeah, considering Stan Mortensen fell asleep, in his own words, on the coach from the hotel to Wembley, he was that relaxed about the final.
And then casually scored a hat-trick in the FA Cup final. Yeah.
It gives me very Andrea Pirlo in the fact that he was quoted as saying he played PS2 all day prior to winning the World Cup with Italy in 2006, I believe.
That guy is just the definition of cool, isn't it?
Exactly. So I think Stan Mortensen and Andrea Pirlo should be held on similar levels. But Stan Mortensen also stated about Joe's pre-match tactics by saying, we didn't even have any talks or tactics or anything like that, because Joe used to come in, Stan Matthews would say something like, Joe, tell us a story. And then he would tell us some humorous story and we'd all go out laughing our heads off.
Yeah, and I think summing up like what you say, like his team talks or his coaching methods, one of the things I found really crazy, especially when you're looking at it from like modern times, is how the right back in the FA Cup final, Eddie Shinwell, he actually lived in Derbyshire and used to train with Chesterfield, who were a third division club at the time, and then complained when on the week of the final he did actually have to go and train with Blackpool. Like, this is crazy. He's training with another team in the third division the whole time. Like, you think now you're practicing formations, you're practicing shape and everything all week. Yeah, and he's just chilling in Chesterfield with another team.
Joe Smith was also quite frank with some of the players post-match. In fact, letting know Bill Perry, who scored the winner after the game, that he should have won the game 6 minutes before that with another chance. So Joe Smith feels like quite a casual man, especially at the big time. Maybe he was used to this level of pressure.
I also love the fact that Bill Perry, who scored the winner, you know, after the game, is probably expecting Joe Smith to be hugging him, telling him, you know, you've done this for me, you've done this. Apparently Joe actually just went up to Bill and said, you're a very lucky fella, you came to this country in 1949 and within 5 years you've been to two FA Cup finals.
It gives me very like, I've got you here now, son. Know your place. So maybe behind the scenes Joe Smith ruled with an iron fist, potentially, behind the scenes. That we'll never know, potentially. But in celebration of that massive cup victory, overestimated 500,000 people descended on Blackpool as the cup was taken through Preston, which I feel is quite a cocky measure to take your maiden FA Cup win through the city of your rivals.
It's just to rub it in a little bit.
And then through Lytham and St Anne's, and then through into the city of Blackpool. Stanley Matthews addressed the crowds in a very noble fashion, saying, I've been told by a few people that I'm the match winner, but I don't believe that for several reasons. There are 11 match winners behind me, which I think is a very noble thing to say.
He always rejected the whole Matthews final name. He wasn't a fan of that and said either it should be going to Morty or it should be like what you've just said there. Like, it was the full team, it was 11 players.
Even the Bolton players who faced Blackpool on that fateful day gave some strange accounts stating that even Stanley Matthews or Stan Mortensen, neither of them were actually man of the match. And in fact, it was Ernie Taylor, the central midfielder, with quotes like, he gave Matthews the ball when he wanted it, how he wanted it, and where he wanted it. Ernie Taylor did the damage. Matthews did well to provide the assists for the goals, but it was Ernie that did the damage by pulling us out of position so he could slip the ball in for Matthews, which I feel, in hindsight, might be a little bit of sour grapes from some of the Bolton players.
Pretty cynical, really. When you watch the footage of the game, like, he is just ridiculously good. Like, he just looks way better than everybody else on the field.
And at Birmingham's Aston Villa ground, another 70,000 enthusiasts pack in to see Stanley Matthews, Blackpool's right winger, run rings round a shaky Spurs defence. The little man in the overlong shorts opens up his usual brilliant partnership with England colleague Stanley Mortensen, number 8. In best international style, Matthews dribbles through again, and from his pass, Mortensen completes his hat-trick. So, Blackpool and Manchester will make it an All-Lancashire Cup final.
So Joe Smith wasn't just the mastermind behind that fantastic final. He also had a good eye for spotting talent.
Yeah, you know, he could have even maybe had an alternative career as a scout if you had to believe that in 1954, a young footballer by the name of Jimmy Armfield was spotted by Joe at a practice match at Bloomfield Road.
In a similar way to Stanley Matthews, Armfield's family had moved to Blackpool during World War II, and Smith offered him a trial as he signed for the club in 1954.
Jimmy would join Blackpool just a year after they won the FA Cup. He'd gone to be part of the side that finished as First Division runners-up in the 55-56 season.
Jimmy also went on to be voted as the Young Player of the Year in 1959, and in 1966 he narrowly lost out to Bobby Charlton for Player of the Year.
Jimmy would go on to spend 17 years at Blackpool. Sadly, he just missed the sort of glory era. Like we said earlier, he joins the year after the club wins the FA Cup. The one sort of exception to this time when he's there is when they win promotion to the First Division in the 69-70 season. But I think his England career was still pretty good.
He captained the country on 15 occasions between 1959 and 1966. He played in the 1962 World Cup in Chile, in which he was claimed as the best right-back in the world at the time.
Yeah, and also voted the best right-back in Europe between 62 and 64. He was England captain at the 62 World Cup. So he would have been captain at the 66 World Cup, but was injured during the build-up, lost his place to George Cohen, and obviously that team, the rest is history.
Unfortunate for him. But still, like, throughout the 1962 to 1964, him being declared the best right-back in Europe is giving, like, both of us massive Dani Alves vibes, so to speak.
There's actually a great quote from Gordon Taylor, the chief exec of the PFA, sadly when Jimmy died in 2018. He said that he was one of the innovators. He invented the overlapping fullback, which initially frustrated Joe Smith. And he said to Jimmy, "Look, son, we've got Stanley Matthews to do that." Which I'm loving this, like you said, Dani Alves. You imagine Pep Guardiola, that peak Barcelona team. Like, "Look, Danny, we've got Messi to do that."
Yeah, no overlapping. We need a solid back four. None of this attacking stuff.
But yeah, Jimmy, he loved the club and he loved the town itself. He would go on to be the very opposite of a journeyman. 627 appearances for Blackpool. Remaining for his full career a one-club man.
Another unfortunate marker for Jimmy's career was the fact that he lost his place in the 1966 World Cup team. And back then, only the 11 players at the end of the game received medals.
Yeah, which is great. Like, you imagine if you started the World Cup final, got subbed off, having a time-wasting sub in the 89th minute or something, and you wouldn't get a medal.
None of that time-wasting back then, none of that. But then luckily, in 2009, after the FA had campaigned for many years, Armfield was presented his medal by Prime Minister at the time, Gordon Brown.
Jimmy had actually gone to have a very successful managerial and media career. He started his managerial career at Bolton, like, not long after he'd retired. Won promotion to the second division in his second season as champions. And of course, I think most famously, as a lot of people will remember him, as Leeds United manager in that infamous 1974 European Cup final.
He replaced Brian Clough at Leeds United after his ill-fated reign, and they went on to beat Barcelona on the way to that infamous 74 European Cup final.
Yeah, losing 2-0 to Bayern Munich. We probably could do a full podcast on just that final alone, maybe, and some of the refereeing decisions, Leeds fans. Yeah.
One of the most controversial European Cup finals of all time. However, later, Armfield would go on to work for the BBC for over 40 years.
Yeah, and something I didn't know before we started researching is later on in his life, he had like a consultant role for the FA and sort of gave advice on hiring England managers. And apparently, the FA had like some serious doubts about Terry Venables. Like, some people wanted him, some people didn't. And apparently Jimmy declared he is the right man for England. And obviously Venables would go on to lead like that England team to that Euro 96 semi-final against Germany.
Memorable campaign.
Yeah.
Jimmy undoubtedly can be held amongst the likes of Stanley Matthews and Morty as true legends for the Seasiders. In fact, getting a statue outside Bloomfield Road in 2009, in which he said, "I feel quite humble about it, and I must be honest, I will be very proud to see it, as with the stand. As Blackpool is my team and my town, it is nice to think that anything I've done for this club has been appreciated, and all people like to think that."
such a huge legend, and considering how good he was winning these awards for being the best right back in Europe, the best right back in the world, it's sad that he was with the club, like, you know, after the success. But in a way, it's also quite nice because he proved his loyalty to the club. He played his entire career there, and like what you've just said, he loved this town, he loved the club. Like,
sticking with the club through what a guy. Maybe a kind of poorer period.
Yeah.
He was a true Blackpool and footballing hero, and unfortunately he passed away on the 22nd of January in 2018 in Blackpool at the age of 82.
Moving back slightly to just after the final and just after Jimmy had signed, by this point the success is starting to dry up, like getting past this really successful period. So attendances were down significantly, and by this point, it sounds crazy to say, only four home games attracted over 30,000 people. And for Blackpool standards at this point, that isn't a lot of people, which they'd kill for that now. But yeah, so this prompted the local newspaper to declare that Blackpool did not deserve first division football unless a new, comfortable stadium was built, and it could not see football being played in the town much longer. As we all know, fans had to wait another 40 years before any even modernisation got underway, and we're still waiting for a ground
it's
now.
It's strange to think that the same fans are still waiting. That's part of 70 years ago.
Yeah, would then sort of be a running theme for the next 40 plus years.
Mind-boggling to think.
Yeah. As the 50s came to a close, there really was an end of an era, which was when Joe Smith retired as Blackpool manager after 23 years. His final game in charge was a 2-1 defeat to Tottenham at White Hart Lane. By this point, he transformed Blackpool into one of the great sides of the post-war era, and only ill health prevented him from continuing.
What followed were, unfortunately, multiple relegations during the late 60s and then even through into the 80s. However, we stumbled upon a gem of a story throughout this period.
So in 1962, a young man by the name of Chong Hai Doi became the first Asian footballer to move and play in Europe. So he'd actually seen Blackpool play during their visit to Hong Kong in 1958. And after this, he had one ambition, which was his heart was set on becoming a professional footballer in England. And there was one particular player that sort of made him want to do this.
He caught our eye, and he's caught Chong Hai Doi's eye as well. It was Stanley Matthews. I saw Blackpool play in Hong Kong, and they were wonderful. Stanley Matthews was what we call a number one footballer.
So 2 years later, at 19 years of age, he actually approached the club and came to Bloomfield Road, and gave up the chance of playing in the Olympic Games.
After some impressive games as a trialist playing for the reserve side as an amateur, Blackpool offered him a fully fledged contract, and he joyfully signed as a professional in October of 1960.
During a game against Aston Villa reserves, he was even seen to head the ball, which was distinctly out of the common. His comment was, "Why is it called football if you have to head the ball? I must learn to head the ball, and Blackpool are teaching me, but it's not easy."
As much as he had to learn about heading the ball, he also had to learn the English language, talking about how he had watched television and going to the cinema helped tremendously. However, he also had a little bit of a dislike for the TV show Coronation Street, stating, "But Coronation Street, all talk and no action, and that dialect is like trying to learn another language."
Yes, he was actually a teammate of the legend Jimmy Armfield, and he became the first ethnic Chinese player to appear in the top flight of English football, but he only made two appearances,
scoring one goal against Sheffield Wednesday on November the 25th in 1961.
His debut against Wolves actually only lasted 9 minutes because of thick fog, so the 15,000 fans were left a bit confused after coming in, getting ready to watch a game, and 9 minutes later, it's all over.
Unfortunately for what we can maybe say is the first journeyman to feature on our podcast, so he struggled to get into the first team, only playing, as we've said, two first-team games. He returned home.
After returning home, he sent the club a letter where he told them he'd played for a Chinese select XI against a visiting Swedish team and scored a hat-trick. And basically all of this meant he was not going to return to Bloomfield Road, quite sadly.
And with the perspective of the modern era, it seems mad to both of us that like Blackpool haven't quite pushed on with this. It seems like an incredible story. Very individual fact of literally having the first ethnically Chinese player in the whole of England.
I remember when Park Ji-sung was playing for Manchester United, and like everyone in Korea is like a Manchester United fan. It's like, yeah, this is marketing gold. Blackpool were doing this in the 60s. Like, yeah, and what is fantastic is that in 2016, actually, he was a guest of the Blackpool Supporters Trust at Brett Ormerod's testimonial, which I just think is absolutely brilliant. This guy, it's just countless amazing fact after fact. So since the end of his stint with Blackpool in 1962, he remains the first and thus far the only Hong Kong-born footballer to have ever played for a top-flight European club. And he's one of only two Hong Kongers to have played professional football in England. I don't suppose if you know Joey, who the other one is testing you out here.
I've no idea. You've hid this information from me.
Forgive my pronunciation if we do have anybody from Hong Kong listening or anybody that knows how to pronounce this name. But the other Hong Konger to have played in England is Dai Wai Sun, who actually made his debut in 2017 playing for Bury and was also on the books of Oxford and Wolves as well. So that's one to remember for the pub quiz.
Despite this wholesome story, the final proof that the golden days for Blackpool Football Club had kind of come to a close was during the 1961-62 season, when Stanley Matthews returned to Stoke after 14 years on the Lancashire coast, playing 440 games for the club.
Despite losing Matthews, Blackpool actually ended up finishing the season in 13th, and then not that long after, the 65-66 season, just after England's victory in the 66 World Cup final, Alan Ball was sold to Everton for 112,000, obviously played in the World Cup final. 112,000 is a lot of money for this point.
It was Blackpool's record transfer fee.
This sort of starts a trend that becomes increasingly familiar of selling the players. Like Stanley Matthews has gone back to Stoke, Alan Ball's left for Everton.
In the February of 1967, Joe Smith's replacement, Ron Suart, had been under pressure for several years after failing to recreate the magic of the mythical man and was forced to resign after 9 years in the hot seat. However, this laid the way for one of Blackpool's biggest figures to return to the club, Stan Mortensen.
And so Blackpool, under Morty, spent the 67-68 season challenging hard for promotion, and they went into the final game knowing that 2 points would likely secure a return to the First Division.
And in fact they did, with a 6-3 victory, emphatic.
But after the premature celebrations had died down, the news came in that their nearest rivals, Queen's Park Rangers, had won at Villa Park by virtue of a last-minute own goal. QPR's 0.21 better goal average, we'll explain more in a second, meant they were promoted alongside champions Ipswich Town.
Mark found great pleasure in finding out what goal average was, as it was completely new to me and Mark before researching.
You make me sound a little bit strange there, but yes, goal average. So it was first introduced as a tiebreaker in football at the 1970 World Cup. Goal average was the number of goals scored divided by the number of goals conceded. The main reason why they replaced it is to encourage more attacking football and encouraging teams to try and score more goals. But yeah, so QPR's 0.21 better goal average meant they were promoted alongside Ipswich Town.
God help the fans in the stadium trying to figure that out whilst it was all going on.
I'm just having visions of, you know, like when you go to a football match and there's like some old bloke always brings his radio. Some guy with like a calculator.
A little transistor radio and yeah, calculator and all that. I'm very happy we moved away from it in all honesty.
Goal difference is just so much better.
Thank you. In 1969, the board perhaps panicked into action by the lack of immediate success and disturbed by the rumours of player indiscipline and sacked Morty. Their decision was met with a mixture of shock and anger by the Blackpool faithful, as Mortensen was a popular manager as he was a player.
I'm getting strong Frank Lampard vibes. There was brief glimmers of success during the 70s, though. The promotion from Division 2 was runners-up in the 69-70 season, being the main one. The win that sealed this famously comes against fierce rivals Preston North End.
Promotion was gained on an emotional light at the Preston North End's Deepdale Stadium in the West Lancashire Derby, when a Fred Pickering hat-trick gave Blackpool a massive 3-0 victory.
There was a 34,000 attendance at the stadium, which they reckon about 20,000 were Blackpool fans who had made the short trip to Preston. And what makes this story even more interesting, Blackpool fans are, you know, loving it. They're getting promoted against your rivals. But to make it even sweeter and probably even harsher and like more horrible for Preston fans is the fact that this result also plunges them into further trouble just after Preston were relegated for the third division for the first time in their history.
That's when, in fact, Jimmy Armfield says that's when the rivalry with the Shaggers, that's when the real rivalry started the night. Even though it put two divisions between the teams, it was such a significant result.
Even though they're not going to be playing each other for the next few years, like to put two divisions, like basically you get promoted and you relegate your main rivals at their ground. It's brutal.
It's just like a lovely cherry on top of a very nice cake in terms of Blackpool's promotion.
But like we said, the 70s, with brief glimmers of, you know, like what we just spoke about, relegating your rivals, getting promoted, was one of the brief bits of positivity. But we did find some absolute gold, which didn't come in the normal league season.
We were delighted to stumble upon this invention, which was the Anglo-Italian Cup. It was a pre-season tournament during the summer of 1971, and Blackpool had the chance to regain some pride when they entered into this cup.
You know, the one thing I'm not sure whether, like, all 70s pre-season football was like this good, or whether Blackpool just had an amazing 70s pre-season history. But basically the Anglo-Italian Cup was a competition that involved 12 teams. You got 6 from England, 6 from Italy, with the winners from each group meeting in the final. And this format sounds amazing. Like, I don't know about you, but I have very little interest in pre-season football. Like, if it's maybe your club and you watch a couple of games, but like, I would never tune into the Emirates Cup.
When there's talk of this European Super League and that these big clubs are trying to make this stupid tournament, why don't they just do something similar to this? Because in the summer, when there's no World Cup or major tournament on, I would happily tune in to watch Inter Milan take on, say, Chelsea, or Liverpool taking on, say, Napoli.
I honestly would sign the petition to bring back the Anglo-Italian Cup right now.
I love it. I would absolutely see it.
Yeah. So anyway, so 1971 Anglo-Italian Cup. Blackpool actually finished top of the English group by winning twice, drawing once, and losing another game. They scored more teams than any other in the qualifying matches, which set up a final against Bologna.
The final was played at Bologna's home stadium, the Stadio Renato Dell'Aura, and was played in front of 40,000 fans who saw Blackpool win 2-1 after extra time.
The victory gave the club a morale boost for the forthcoming league season, and the next day, thousands of ecstatic Blackpool fans lined the promenade and gathered outside the town hall to welcome them home. But there was a great goal in that final, which wouldn't remotely look out of place nowadays.
You can go and find the full game back. Yeah. And me and Mark enjoyed watching the entire thing through. It's such a lovely flashback to football from a different era, and such a quirky way in this mad pre-season tournament. It just makes for very refreshing watching when we're currently starved of fans and atmosphere and just kind of wacky ideas in football.
Yeah, and I'd like to thank whichever legend uploaded the full 1971 Anglo-Italian Cup final to YouTube. Passed a good couple of hours for me. Yeah. More interesting than the 1971 Anglo-Italian Cup is the fact that a year later, Blackpool come back to defend their title. So this is 1972 pre-season. Once again, made it to the final. So 70s pre-season tournaments, Blackpool are your team.
Some of these results en route to the final were glorious. They won all of their group matches, including a 10-0 home victory over Lanerossi Vincenzia, which remains their record victory to date.
In the final, however, they met far stiffer competition in the form of a little club from Rome, AS Roma, and were soundly beaten 3-1 in front of 70,000 fans at the Stadio Olimpico.
Can't really blame the Seasiders, I don't think, for that result. I can't even imagine what it must be like walking into that fierce atmosphere at the Stadio Olimpico.
Whoever uploaded the 1971 final did not upload the 1972 final, which I was very disappointed about.
A bit of a shame, yeah. Unfortunately.
And at the end of the 73-74 season, Blackpool swapped the Lancashire coast for the Italian Riviera for the Calgaris International Tournament in Northern Italy.
This was slightly different to the Anglo-Italian Cup, as it was an under-21 knockout tournament named after local legend Umberto Calgaris. Blackpool tour manager Eddie Quigley was in charge of 17 young Blackpool players who made the trip.
Yeah, and the tournament was structured along the lines of the World Cup, with each team appearing in a group of four. Blackpool's opening game in the tournament was a goalless draw against Napoli, but there's some great names coming up. This was followed by a 2-0 victory over CSK Sofia, the Bulgarian team, a 5-0 win against AC Milan. Had Milan beaten Blackpool, they would have topped their group, with Blackpool not even finishing second place.
Blackpool went on to face once again Lanerossi Vincenzia once more in the semi-finals. The score was tied at 1-1 at the end of normal time. It went to penalties, with the English side winning 4-3. Blackpool keeper Colin King saved 2 of 5 penalties he faced.
A lot closer than the last meeting against Lanerossi Vicenza.
Maybe it was one of those classic pinning the 10-0 to the dressing room wall jobs.
Yeah, pointing to that, and then, we're doing it for them fans. Like, come all this way. We're not having another one of them.
We're not having them coming to our backyard and stuffing us 10-0 again.
We go again.
Napoli were Blackpool's opponents in the final. A double from Stuart Parker and one from David Tong gave the Tangerines a 3-1 victory. Blackpool had become the first English club to win this tournament.
Italy obviously proving to be a very good hunting ground for 70s Blackpool.
But it's going to be Bologna, who finished fifth in the Italian league last season, to kick off wearing the dark shorts and what are in fact red shirts. Referee Paul Schiller checking with his linesman, and so Blackpool have their wind at the back as we go off on this Anglo-Italian Cup final. Sadik. Pass intended for Bentley. Hatton. Craven. Back again for Craven. Oh, what a beautifully taken goal We looked at the linesman on this side because that was close, but Craven took it well, and the linesman held his flag down. Nice ball up to Byrne. Again, Craven on his own in the middle, but there are two others across the box. Byrne's trying well, and he makes it! Mickey Byrne!
Alan Brown, another former Blackpool player, had returned to manage the club for the 76-77 season. The season saw them battle for promotion and eventually finish in fifth place, just missing out to a return to Division 1 by 2 points.
During the next season, the club were again challenging for promotion, but after an argument with chairman Billy Cartmell, Brown was sacked.
Cartmell had made remarks in the Daily newspaper about Brown's job being on the line, despite a run of wins in the recent games, to which Brown responded by calling the chairman a backstabbing rat, and the board then felt this was unacceptable.
Absolutely fantastic language there. Don't see that too often anymore. After his departure, Blackpool won only one more game, dropped down the table and were narrowly relegated at the end of the season.
Brown's departure actually started a downward spiral that would continue for many years. And in fact, the club actually went on to spend the next nearly 30 years in the lower divisions of the Football League. Off the field, the club was now facing large bills for the upkeep of the now dilapidated Bloomfield Road Stadium, with a supermarket chain looming threateningly trying to buy the site. And we've heard this before in this story, haven't we? Bloomfield Road falling apart. And I think the 80s it had hit a real low.
It seemed at one stage that the final home game of the season in the 1986 season against Newport County would be the last time the team was going to play in Blackpool, with talk of a move to Preston.
And I'm so glad that didn't happen. Like, playing in Preston.
How awful for the Blackpool faithful would that have been, having to travel to the home of their arch rivals every week in and week out, to support your local team. Horrible thought.
It's funny how you speak about awful things for Blackpool fans, because in 1987, a man called Owen Oyston bought a large stake in the then struggling club.
And this feels like a perfect time to end part one of our Blackpool story. Sorry, Blackpool fans, there was just so many amazing tales that we had to split it into two parts.
But thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in for part two. We've got everything from Big Sam and dodgy owners all the way to Ian Holloway and a Premier League dream.
Make sure to like, rate, and do all that good stuff to help the algorithm and push us out to people. And from everyone here at the Journeyman Podcast, make sure to come back for part two of this amazing story.
See you next time.